This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time, and soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well-prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
Retirement is great in that it gives you an opportunity to spend more time on things that you would have liked to during your full-time working years. And if you're like the clients I work with, fitness is at the top of your list because it matters. It affects all the rest of the time that you have in retirement. But where do you start? This is a special best-of episode of the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. It includes short snippets of podcast conversations you may have missed on a specific topic. And today, we're talking about fitness. You'll find links to the full conversations in the show notes so you can listen to any or all of the ones that you may have missed or want to hear again, because this is an important topic. So back to the question, where do you start? Can be overwhelming to begin, but Kelly McGonigal, the author of the book, The Joy of Movement, shared that it actually starts with how you think about working out, reframing that, and becoming aware that exercise can come in many forms. And here's the kicker, it actually can be really fun and something you will want to do.
Well, there's one thing that happens almost universally, it's called the feel better effect. And that's the fact that if you have been inactive, you've been sitting around, lying around, sedentary for any period of time, and then you begin to move your body. So you get your heart rate up a little bit, your blood is flowing to your muscles, you're breathing more deeply. Most people will immediately feel more energy and more positive. That's sort of how psychologists talk about mood. How much energy do you have and how positive or negative is your outlook? And no matter where you start out, you could start out low energy and negative, you know, depressed or bored or feeling a lack of hope. And getting active in any way tends to move you in that direction of feeling more energy and more positive. You could start out feeling really high energy and negative, like angry or anxious, and it somehow transforms that energy into a more positive source of energy that you can use. The runner's high is actually something that I call the exercise high or even the persistence high, because you don't have to run to get it. So you're a runner, you know, you've had it running, but I'm not a runner. And I tend to experience it when I'm dancing or when I'm doing flow yoga. And people can experience it in any activity where basically you're engaged in continuous movement or continuous effort at a level that is not easy and is not totally exhausting. So for most people, that would be something like a brisk walk or a jog, or it's just something where you can still breathe and you can keep going. It doesn't feel like you're giving every ounce of what you have to get through the next second of it. And we know that when people are working at that level, around 20 minutes, there seem to be changes in your brain that kick in that, first of all, really relieve stress and anxiety and worry and physical pain. So a lot of the stuff that's happening inside of you that causes us suffering, it basically recedes. And things that make us feel good, whether it's hope, whether it's confidence, whether it's feeling connected to others, all the stuff going on in our brains that give us a sense of a pleasure or joy, that becomes enhanced. And people describe that sometimes even to a degree of, you know, feeling euphoric when they exercise. And sometimes it's more subtle, where you start out your workout feeling stressed out, maybe feeling a little isolated. And at that 20-minute mark, man, your body feels like you're in the zone with whatever movement you're doing. It physically feels better. And you just suddenly feel so much more optimistic about your capability to handle what's going on in your life. You feel more connected to the people in your life. Everything just seems better. That's the main psychological effect. And we even now know what's going on in the brain that's probably causing that. And that is the effort that you are engaged in basically convinces your brain to release brain chemicals like endocannabinoids and endorphins and dopamine that make you feel good, and also that sort of nudge you in the direction of being a braver version of yourself, sort of more willing to persist and do difficult things in order to reach meaningful goals, and also a more social version of yourself. So particularly endocannabinoids and endorphins, they're social bonding brain chemicals. And when their levels are higher in your brain, you find it easier to reach out to others. You find it more pleasurable to spend time with others. Other people's jokes are funnier. It feels better to get a high five or a hug. It feels like you get more of a warm glow if you cooperate with other people. And so this is part of what an exercise high does to you. It makes you feel good, and it also nudges you in this direction of being a better version of yourself. And I feel like that's really underestimated.
Former NFL strength training coach Dave Durrell shares with us why strength training is the foundation of any fitness plan and why he believes you can get stronger after 50.
Strength training is much less about appearance and much more about health and function. Building and maintaining a high level of muscular strength makes all physical activity easier. And that's going to allow people, especially older people, to have their highest possible level of pain-free function. So why is that important? What this does, Joe, is this brings the freedom for people to say yes to those bucket list items that they haven't checked off yet. The ones, the experiences that are going to create lasting memories for them, whether it's that family trip you've been planning for years to Machu Picchu, whether you want to try paddleboarding for the first time, or even just being able to join into the backyard volleyball game at the next family reunion. A lot of people over 50, Joe, have the resources now, both time-wise and financially, to really do some of these things that they've always wanted to do. But the question I have for people is, are you going to be physically ready to do those things? And getting on a consistent, proper strength training program will help with that. And then, of course, Joe, there's many health benefits associated with strength training, especially for people over 50. There's actually too many in total for me to list in the time that we have today, but I'll give you a few that are especially important for people over 50. Strength training can improve glucose metabolism, which of course is important for combating diabetes. Strength training also increases your resting metabolic rate, which is basically the amount of calories you burn at rest. Your muscles are your calorie burning engines, Joe. So the bigger and stronger they are, the more calories they need, even on the days that you're resting, which leaves less calories left over to be stored as fat. Strength training reduces pain and discomfort from arthritis. It also improves bone mineral density, which of course is important for those at risk for osteoporosis. It has a beneficial effect on self-esteem, that sense of accomplishment you get from progressing through a strength training program. And here's an exciting one for us older folks, Joe, that a lot of people don't think about. Strength training has been shown in studies to improve executive cognitive function in seniors. Things like improved task performance, enhanced selective attention, and conflict resolution. Obviously, cognitive impairment and dementia are big healthcare issues for seniors. And strength training only once or twice a week has been shown to combat cognitive decline. In fact, Joe, properly performed strength training, to my way of thinking, is the closest thing we have to a real-life fountain of youth. As you say on your website, a 20-plus year retirement is a terrible thing to waste. And I believe strength training done properly and consistently will help you keep strong and healthy enough to make the most of those years. So I think it fits perfectly with the retirement wisdom theme. Well, Joe, once we get into probably our 40s or so, there's a physiological process called sarcopenia that begins to manifest itself, and it sticks with us for life. What sarcopenia is, it's an age-related muscle loss, and experts estimate it causes us to lose around half a pound of muscle per year on average. That's about 5 pounds of movement-producing muscle tissue per decade. This would be like the engine in your car, Joe, shrinking and losing horsepower every year. It's not a good thing. And it gets worse. Assuming we maintain the same eating habits throughout the years, that lost muscle will be replaced by stored body fat. So even if our body weight stays the same over the years, we're actually getting weaker and fatter as a natural consequence of aging. Well, the point is that if we don't do anything, we don't stay the same. We actually get worse because our ability to function independently and our overall health are being eroded just by the passage of time. So the best way to mitigate the effects of sarcopenia is consistent progressive resistance exercise or strength training. Regularly imposing a challenging demand on your muscles will keep them strong and counteract the muscle wasting effects of sarcopenia. And of course, Joe, also not doing strength training as you get older means you will not get the resulting health benefits that I mentioned earlier. So to me, the return on your time investment with strength training is so overwhelmingly positive. I can't think of a good reason not to do it. If you do it properly, it's safe. It doesn't require any athletic skill. It doesn't take a lot of time, and it's sustainable for life. Well, in my view, Joe, strength training should be the foundation of an overall fitness plan.
And science journalist Caroline Williams joined us from the UK to discuss her new book, Move, and to highlight why it's not just about pumping iron. Fitness also is about getting more movement in your day-to-day life in simple, straightforward ways, but also ways that are fun.
Dance is really fascinating. And I could have written a whole book on dance. I got very carried away with this chapter. I had to hack it back quite significantly. And other people, by the way, have written books just about dance and what it does to our psychology. So there are many reasons why humans dance. And you think about it, we are about the only species that dances. And so there's lots of theories about why that is. And one idea is that it helps us to, in our evolution, that it helped us to bond as a society, as a group of people. Because when we were sort of hunting, gathering, we really relied on each other. Humans aren't very strong. We're not very fast. You know, what we do have is social bonds. We work together and we have our brains. So this might be connected. So one of the things that backs this up is some studies that show when you're moving in synchrony with somebody. So when you're moving your body, you have this sense of proprioception, which tells you where your body is in space. And it's a sort of unconscious sense. So you don't need to look down, you know where your body is. When we're moving in synchrony with somebody else, we're also getting information through our eyes about where their body is in space. And when their movements are matching our movements, our brain gets a little bit confused. And sort of the line between us and them gets a little bit blurred. And one idea is that because of this blurring between what's me and what's you, we start to feel more connected. And there's lots of studies that have shown that when people have been moving in synchrony with each other, they do care about each other more. And if you get them to play competitive games, they'll work together more effectively, even toddlers. So they've done experiments where they bounce little toddlers on your knee in time to the music. And then if you put them down and you accidentally drop something, the little toddler is far more likely to pick it up and hand it back to you if you've been bouncing them in synchrony than if you've been doing it all over the place. So it seems to be hardwired into our biology that moving together makes us care about each other. And so given that, you know, we're so lonely, you know, there's this loneliness epidemic that's going on, even though we're more connected than we've ever been, in theory, online, just moving together, however that is, whether it's aerobics, yoga, dancing, Tai Chi, doesn't matter, just moving with other human beings is something that really can make us feel a lot better. The good news for that, if you're not a natural dancer, is that when you're moving in time to music, I was speaking to a neuroscientist called Peter Janata, who's a really interesting guy. And he said, you know, he doesn't really like to dance, but he sort of grooves along to music. And he says, you know, when you're moving in time to music that's made by other human beings and the movements of their bodies, it's like having an invitation to join in with the band. So you're sort of moving along with the movements that they're making to make those noises. And so you can have this sensation and this feeling of being part of something that's bigger than yourself, even if you're just kind of nodding along quietly in the corner somewhere, or even if you're jumping around to music all by yourself, which is what I do quite a lot in the kitchen. So yeah, it's an easy way to feel good. And also if you really go for it, and I had experience of this in sort of freeform dance class that I attended, and I opened the book with this story. It was just really embarrassing. But when I let myself go and went really with the beat, you can get catapulted into this altered state of consciousness where you're sort of not thinking, you're just being. And that's one way to just escape all the stresses of life, and it can just take you out of yourself. And that's a really amazing thing that dance can do to change the way that you're feeling at any one time.
There is one form of exercise that many of us take for granted, and that's walking. It packs tons of benefits, is easy to do, doesn't take much equipment except sneakers, and yet it's sometimes overlooked. Dave Paul shared his learnings about how to get the most out of walking.
I think there are four things that make walking a great fitness solution. One is it's effective as exercise. CDC recommends that we get between 150 and 300 minutes of moderate level of physical activity every week. Walking fits that bill. If you're going 3 to 4 miles an hour, you're in that moderate zone. And 3 to 4 miles an hour, it's not super fast, but it's not what I call grocery store pace. And real quick way, real easy way to determine if you're walking fast enough, just go find a track where you've got 1 mile that's measured out, walk it. And if you can reach the 1 mile point at 20 minutes, you're going 3 miles an hour. If you can hit it at 15 minutes, you're going 4 miles an hour. So you're in the zone that the CDC recommends. So it's effective exercise. It's also flexible. I mean, you don't need a gym. All you need is a front door that opens. And, you know, you can walk at any time of day, in any kind of weather. Not all weather is equally comfortable, but you can still, if you've got the right gear, you can head out. And walking is sustainable. It's the kind of thing, particularly as I'm entering the later season of my life, I'm probably 3 years from retirement now. So I'm thinking ahead and I want a physical activity, exercise that I can sustain and keep doing as I age. And then really for me, the best part of walking that makes it a great fitness solution, it's fun. It's just a lot of fun. You can change it up. You can walk in cities. I love urban exploring with walking. You can go walk in the woods. You can walk in the neighborhood. You can walk with people. You can walk without people and listen to podcasts. It's just a ton of fun. Well, it's actually a little embarrassing because the latest research has just debunked the whole 10,000 step myth as the number you need to reach for health benefits. And now they're determining it's about 7,500 steps, which is about double what the average American walks. So it's, you know, you have to be intentional to reach 7,500, but they've determined that above 7,500, the health benefits really start to plateau. But I just love walking so much that 21,000, it's not a goal anymore. In fact, I don't even know how many steps I walked yesterday. In fact, if you want, I can pull this up and embarrass myself by how many I got yesterday. I'm already at 18,000 today. And yeah, look at this, yesterday, 21,698. It's really a reflection of how much I love walking and how walking has become part of my lifestyle.
So once you get your fitness routines going, how do you stay motivated? Dr. Michelle Seeger of the University of Michigan came on to talk about her new book, The Joy Choice, and also why motivation is one aspect, but staying with it really requires another thing, flexibility.
So when it comes to physical activity, it's straightforward. The answer is that you can learn new reasons that will give you immediate positive feedback for being active. Like, research clearly shows that moving our bodies improves our mood, it boosts energy, it helps us focus more. Who doesn't want those benefits? And that might be the reason you're doing it, but then you have to pick a physical activity that helps you realize that reason. And so people need to kind of break away from part of the all or nothing thinking when it comes to physical activity is it has to feel punishing. It has to be intense, like the kinds of marathons that you might run, or you have to sweat for it to be worth doing. And the research absolutely shows that something is better than nothing. So that's kind of the formula, if you will, for creating a more positive experience with physical activity. But then people say, but I feel good when I eat the cookie instead of the kale. And that may be true. And the new work on eating and changing our relationship with eating is related to the brain and value-based decision-making and mindfulness. And the solution involves not just saying or noticing, gosh, that cookie tastes really good, but noticing if you eat 10 of them, how do you feel? what does it really feel like? What's the overall experience? And what happens is when people be, the research shows that when people become more mindful of what it really feels like when they have a craving and when they may overdo it, it helps them in the brain reevaluate its value from maybe not quite as high to a more realistic, gosh, I really don't feel as good as I anticipate feeling. So that's more complex in a way. But again, that is the answer to the first part of the question. The second part of the question, we can have the highest quality motivation in the world. And by the way, motivation is necessary. It's a very important part of creating lasting change in any behavior. So I disagree with some perspectives that motivation, you can't stay motivated. And so you've got to come up with other options to offset the need for motivation. Motivation, from the frameworks that in the research I follow, that is actually a very crucial part. So we really do have to care what the behavior means to us, why we're doing it, and how we experience it. But then the other part of the equation is, how do we fit into our lives? And when I can be motivated, but then when an unexpected conflict arises to my healthy eating plan or my exercise plan, what do I do? And the old go-to, which is what this book aims to get out of the cultural narrative, is I can't do it all, so I'm not going to do anything. But so the book aims to help people learn to rethink and reframe and re-choose, so that instead of thinking in all or nothing ways, we think, okay, let me harness my attention. Let me notice what type of trap might be trying to get in the way of my decision. Let me name it. And then let me remind myself that research shows that being flexible at these points of conflict, or what I call choice points, is actually related to better ongoing participation or choice making than trying to, you know, hit the bullseye. So we need to learn a new belief system and tactic for addressing the conflicts. Even when we have high quality motivation, we still have to deal with them.
So how do you get started? Or how do you take your fitness routine up a notch? The best way I've found is a method created by Dr. BJ Fogg. He's the head of the Behavioral Design Lab at Stanford, and he created a method called Tiny Habits. It's really a game changer. I've used it personally since 2014, and I also use it where appropriate in my coaching. It really works. And he joined me to explain what's behind it and how it works and how it may help you.
Well, behavior design is the phrase that at Stanford University we came up with to describe a new set of models about human behavior and how to design for it. And so behavior design is a pretty straightforward way of understanding what causes behavior and how you can change it, including habits. And that's really what Tiny Habits is all about. I map out, here's this thing called behavior design.
And you've invested over 20 years researching habit formation. Human behavior is obviously very complex. But your new book, Tiny Habits, lays it out in a very accessible and practical way. How would you explain the Fogg behavior model?
Well, the behavior model in some ways is the fundamental model of behavior design. And it came together for me in 2007. And this model, and it's really easy to understand, applies to all types of behaviors and all habits. It basically has three elements. There's motivation to do a behavior, the ability to do the behavior, and a prompt. And so any behavior will have motivation, ability, and a prompt. And this is what we discovered in research at Stanford and in industry work. And if you make a small tweak to any one of those elements, you can change a behavior. So for example, if you want to stop a habit, if you can remove the motivation, boom, it will stop. If you can't do that, can you remove ability, make it harder to do? You can stop it. Or can you remove the prompt? And you can also use the model for one-time behaviors, for creating habits, and so on. So it's this really pretty straightforward, I think elegant model that you can apply in a whole bunch of ways.
And one thing I notice is when we try to change our behavior, we often lean on motivation. So I'll psych myself up. Or willpower, I'll just gut it out. Why are motivation and willpower problematic?
Yeah, and you know, as you know, that's a big part of Tiny Habits, to say, look, people, stop trying to rely on willpower to change. And guess what? Motivation is unreliable. motivation shifts all the time. Like right now, it's just before lunch for me, or actually it's a little bit after lunchtime. But in an hour or maybe 2 hours after I've eaten, my motivation to eat will go down. So motivation is not a stable thing in our lives, and willpower can get tapped out. So motivation is just one component of the behavior model. So in Tiny Habits, it's about how do you make the behavior really easy to do? That's the ability factor. So you don't have to rely on motivation. And then what's going to prompt your behavior? So instead of obsessing with motivation or willpower, there's a better way to do it that's been road tested with over 40,000 people of making things really, really simple and tiny. And that's why it's called Tiny Habits.
Thanks for listening to this special best of episode on fitness. You'll find links to the full conversations in the show notes, and you can browse all of our episodes at our website, retirementwisdom.com. I hope this inspires you to start your own exercise program or take it up a notch by starting small and starting smart. Don't forget to check with your physician before starting or intensifying any exercise program. But keep an eye out for new episodes. We have new episodes each Monday and twice a month on Thursdays. Thanks for listening.